World Service presents...
This is London.
Welcome to the Surf Europe podcast. I'm Paul Evans.
And I'm Ben Mundy.
In this episode, we ask, is Great Britain once again the sick man of Europe? Only not in a good way. We reflect on the World Surf League's expensive Fijian sausage fest and ask if the coming crop of WCT stars are more red dwarf than supernova. Esteemed author Jamie Brizick joins us down the line from Los Angeles to defend the 1980s and explains why before the books, he was fond of a Czech named Ivan Lendl. Meanwhile, we find out why Justin Bieber called surf photographer Chris Burkard and its implication upon your local surf film festival. And here's a clue. It has to do with a place where people eat roast puffin and sound a bit like this. Celebrity Mona Tim Maddo Madison takes over Mona Monday to lament the sad slide of his Aussie bloke's camping trip into new age organic quinoa, juice in a jam jar, hoo-ha. All this and so much more. Congratulations, friends. You've successfully tuned in to episode 3 of the Surf Europe podcast.
Enjoy this trip. Enjoy this trip. And it is a trip.
Okay, Ben, so let's start off on a positive note. What's been happening lately that's floated your boat? What's made you smile?
I'll tell you what's really good is the Porto Escondido Challenge. That was very good, Paul. That was a big wave competition where lots of men with like big inflatable vests and huge testicles just took off on 15, 20-foot closeouts and pulled into them for about 2 days straight. About 1 in 10, they'd come out of it. Just the rest of the time, they just get annihilated. But I did like, well, A, it was 20 foot and offshore barreling, which is obviously makes for good viewing. B, I like the format. There were six guys, I think, surf for an hour and a half or whatever. So you're just always watching guys getting tubed. They're going to get enough time to do it. And it just was exciting just to see grown men get obliterated and get sand shot up their anus. What about you, Paul? What's been?
Well, actually, Ben, the Brexit, believe it or not, Britain voting to leave the EU. Now, generally, obviously, given my sort of current situation, I live in France, so it's probably not that good for me personally or my family. But, however, I'm taking, you know, trying to look for a positive in there. I think for British surfing, it might not be such a bad thing. Just bear with me. Like, in the 80s... English football teams were excluded from European competition because of hooliganism. And, you know, after a few years in the wilderness, we came back, Italia 90. We were amazing. We had an amazing team. We had the best player, Gazza. We had Lineker, joint top scorer. We won the Fair Play Award, the FIFA Fair Play Award. We even had the best song, New Order, for God's sake. So I think maybe, yeah, just a little while in kind of isolation, self-imposed isolation, might do British surfing a world of good. On top of that, people that did want to go for the Brexit were extolling the virtues of kind of building our links with the former Commonwealth nations like Australia, of course, and, you know, some of those great surfing nations, South Africa, I'll even just say New Zealand for the sake of it. So maybe we'll get, you know, an influx of some of those guys who find it easier to come over and live, and they'll help sort of develop British surfing. You with me? Or not really?
So what you're saying...
What have the French and the Spanish done for British surfing and since the Maastricht Treaty of 92? Have they done much?
Nothing at all.
On that note, I think a lot of people in Europe didn't realise that Britain was actually in the EU until the Brexit referendum. When I first started to surf Europe, I remember a couple of my French colleagues in the office telling me that Eric Ribier was the first European surfer to qualify for the CT. I was like, man, I'm pretty sure that's Russ. Pretty sure Russ was on the CT for 3 years. Starting from 99, they're like, no, that's not Europe. Britain's not in Europe. I was like,
it's not now.
Ben, what else have you got that's
good? A guy called Matty Gillette, he's invented the two shoe, which, Paul, is a shoe, no, well, a flip flop or a thong, which, with a simple push of a finger, transforms into a shoe. Now, this is probably one of the most pressing sort of inventions to one of Australia's greatest problems, which is when you're out on the piss and you're wearing thongs on the balcony, and then obviously the time goes on, the day turns to night, and you need to get into the club. The Australian bouncers are notorious for being particularly
cunts.
Cunts and being particularly oppressive when it comes to footwear. With the two-shoe, you flop it around, you've got your shoes on, you're ready to roll, and just life, you know, marches on into the evening.
I got to,
and so
I
that's
got
one of them.
Two questions, Ben. First one, is it better than the Mick Fanning Reef sandal that had a bottle opener on the bottom that would invariably get clogged with sort of dog shit and chewing gum, and then you just put it around what you're going to put your mouth around? Is it better than that?
Yeah, it's a similar vein of, like, you know, incredible invention. Yeah. But I think it's better than that because the hygiene factor is stronger.
Yeah.
And the Reef sandal doesn't get you into nightclubs.
Yeah, your mate... I would suggest that your mate's probably unlikely to make quite as much money as Mick is rumoured to have made from that Reef sandal. The second question is, can the Mad Hooies do shoeies out of it?
Definitely. He went on Dragon's Den. You talk about money. Well, he made some nutbag in Australia, invested $200,000 into the invention. So I look forward to seeing the two-shoe coming to you soon. And what else have you got that's good? Apart from the Brexit poll.
The Euros, the football tournament's on at the moment.
You're going very football European centric for a surf podcast.
You've probably heard of it. Well, I'm talking about from a surfing point of view.
Okay.
Basically, let's say, I mean, it didn't go quite so well. We're recording the morning after the England-Iceland game. I'm going to come on to that. But let's talk about the group stage. Let's say there's a couple of sort of fairly average-ish matches. You know, some days there were, like, you'd have an afternoon game and then an early evening game. If the surf's not that good, it's just a brilliant way of organising your day. You've got a 3 o'clock kickoff, you've got a 6 o'clock kickoff game. You know, it's going to take a couple of hours. So you've got the little surf window in between the two. And sometimes it's really hard to decide what tide, when shall I go? Shall I go surf now or later? That kind of makes your mind up for you. And, you know, this is also something that any great sporting event, similar during the Ashes, you watch a game towards the end. Maybe you miss the last 10 minutes if it's boring or someone's already a couple of goals up. You go for your surf, and you know to end your surf and get back just in time. You have your shower, crack a beer, turn the telly on, and just in time for kickoff. What's better than that?
Yeah, so I guess you're liking an enforced structure into your poor time management.
Yeah, that's it. You nailed it there, essentially. What have you got that you haven't enjoyed so much? What's bad?
Waves have been destroyed, this time in Bali. It was called Nikos, which is a pretty well sort of kept secret, but a quality right-hand barrel on the East Coast. And the King of Thailand, in all his wisdom, has just got a massive range of hotels, and he built a hotel and put a lovely break wall that went straight through the lineup, pretty much dividing the takeoff spot and destroying the wave.
So you're blaming the Thais, I blame the Aussies.
Yeah, well, in this case, overdevelopment of Bali, Australia has played its part, and me personally, I've sold the Indo Dream. I've been involved in surf magazines for 15 years.
The boganisation of Bali.
Yeah, so we've all got a part to play in the development, overdevelopment of Bali, and the latest sort of victim is a world-class wave, and maybe we should all think about what we can do to help manage that development. What can we do personally and collectively to try and make our world a better place, Paul? Have you got something bad that's not related to football or the European?
Well, actually, it's the Brexit, isn't it? the Brexit, fucking disaster. Yeah, do I really need to explain why that's a bad thing? Just think of the sort of European utopia where you could go and live in any one of 29 member states, enjoy the same rights as a citizen of that country. Just kind of, it just sort of seemed like Europe at least was our oyster, wasn't it? You go and live and work anywhere, surf, you could even go on the dole. Dream's over now, mate. Ben Mundy, what else have you got that's bad?
Well, last, probably 2 weeks ago, I think, in between the last two podcasts, there was a massive swell on the east coast of Australia. I don't know if you saw it. It was huge. It was perfect. I mean, for that part of the world. And I had photos come into my home break. It was, you know, 10 foot and perfect, which happens about once every, I don't know, 4,000 years. And I was just livid, Paul. I was fucking so upset. I was angry. I was kicking the dog. I was fucking around. I was mad. You know, I got photos of my mate, Jonesy, who was actually borrowed my 7.7 that's kept in the in his garage. He was riding my board getting 10-foot pits. That made me even more angrier. And I was just thinking, you know what? I haven't lived there for about 20 years. Even if I did live there, I probably wouldn't have surfed. It was a Monday. I probably would have been working or found some excuse because it was too big. But even though all those factors, it still made me angry. When you miss out on waves at your home break, once in a decade top swell, oh, that's bad, Paul.
Yeah,
that's
I know what you really mean. Surfers can be a bit irrational with that. Sometimes you're on like a mental-wide boat trip, aren't you? And kind of, yeah, it's a pretty good time. And one of your mates gets a text and gets really upset because they've heard this sort of that wobbly sort of spot X non-beach break is like 3 foot and cross shore. Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? How much we hate missing out on our home breaks.
Yeah, well, exactly. You're in there at Uluwatu, and then someone says, "Oh, the banks down at Second Creek are all time." You're like, "Wow, are they? I mean, are they really?" But this one was bona fide, and yes, it hurts. It hurts, Paul. What have you got?
Iceland.
Iceland. Just don't like it.
Yeah, no, this is in no way a reflection on last night's football because Iceland were brilliant and hats off to them. No, I'm just, I was down at the San Sebastian Surf Film Festival recently, which is brilliant. Best surf film festival in the world. Love it. But once again, I noticed there's a hell of a lot of content, people making films about going to Iceland and surfing. There's one French girl and her boyfriend, they went skiing with sort of sleds in Iceland, obviously, and went to surf. It was basically someone going on holiday with 20 grand's worth of mountaineering equipment. That's not a premise for a movie, okay? And then one of the main feature films, I mean, it was quite well done, it was well made, but it was about Iceland. Just when, at which point will we say we've probably had enough movies about going surfing in Iceland? When do you think that might happen, Ben?
Well, I tell you what, that tipping point has to be coming close because I heard on the grapevine that Chris Burkhardt, who is obviously one of the world's premier photographers, who spent not Lance Burkhardt, the character in North Shore, Chris Burkhardt, the photographer, he was in Iceland, got called up by Justin Bieber. And he wanted Chris to be his personal travel guide. So that's when you know that shit's gone too far, that Iceland is overblown, and that, yeah, we've had enough. If I see one more 2-foot right-hander peeling down in front of a, an ice-capped mountain...
Fucking embarrassing. Waste of our time. Fucking waste of our time.
Der Surf Europa Podcast.
Opposite end of the surfing spectrum to Iceland, Fiji, events just wrapped up. Are you stoked?
I mean, there was a bit of a waiting period in the middle there, wasn't there, where it was like...
A drinking period.
Yeah, it was a good old-fashioned piss-up. Yeah, it's a bit of a piss. I mean, it was great. I like how Doug Rosella doing a good job, to be fair, of portraying themselves as his ultimate athletic sport, where the professionals are doing crunches on the beach, and then you just look up and there's 50 men, all with mohawks, clearly drunk out of their mind.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed it.
There don't seem to be a lot of girls at those parties either, too, there.
No, there's not. No, it's a bit of a good old-fashioned sausage sizzle. Mm. A tropical sausage sizzle. But once that finished and the surf started pumping, it actually it got pretty cool to watch. The Wilco was another outstanding effort from the man. He didn't even seem to be partaking in those festivities. I heard he was doing some, like, rock crunches with bunches of coral up the beach. And
bloody
when it's 10
hell.
To 12 foot wash-throughs, Paul, I don't know if you've surfed Cloud Break at 10 to 12 foot wash-throughs.
No.
Neither have I. But it looks quite difficult with duck diving a lot of 10, 12 foot waves on a ledge. It doesn't looks like you need to be quite fit.
I surfed it 3 foot sort of cross shore, really strong kind of wind howling up the face.
All right, difficult. Well, you know how the the physical requirements you need.
Yeah.
For such conditions.
And Medina won, your boy Wilco in the final. Obviously, you're pretty pleased about that. Still looking good, still number one, wearing the yellow jersey. Is that good?
Yeah, I think the novelty's worn off, Paul. It's a bit like, well, he's just been wearing it now for 5 or 6 events. It's just like, he's just in the lead. And he's got a massive lead, 10,000 points or 8,500 points. That's a big lead. So, yeah, his to lose.
Do you remember where they had the Quick Pro France in, I think it was in 2012 or 2011, it was fucking pumping gravier, really big. It was that year when Adam Melling had that mental wipeout. Anyway, there was like the semi was Dane against Kelly. Was it? Remember that one? And the waves were amazing, and like, you know, Dane was just sort of at the peak of his powers, and Kelly was like still good. And imagine if then, sort of during that semi or whatever, if I said to you, Ben, in 4 years, coming into J-Bay, so like well into the season, the defending world champion's going to be Adriana de Souza, and the world title race leader will be Matt Wilkinson. Would that be a situation you would have relished? Is that what you thought surfing had in store for us?
What are you saying, Paul? You're saying that you're worried about the future, the talent pool.
I'm just... Are we
surfing? Are we on a dip? Are we on a precipice and we're about to go forever downhill?
Yeah, well, we may be a bit spoiled. I mean, of course, Fiji Taj bowed out, like we lost him. You know, Mick's kind of... Well, he's sort of in semi-retirement, soon to be full-time. Kelly's, you know, pretty much sort of a spent force in terms of a world title threat. Joel, you would probably say, isn't that far away. Even if you look back a bit further, like even like the Hobgoods and stuff like that we lost recently, they were, you know, they sort of were at times kind of derided, but they're also fairly sort of thoroughbred. Are we like replacing those kind of guys with like legitimate kind of enduring sort of stars? Will we look back at some of the guys, you know, or a lot of the guys up in the 34 now and go, you know, are they kind of real timeless sort of classics?
What, Chow Belly? Yeah, no, I think those guys are. I think they're irreplaceable in many ways. It's like following on that those five surfers you mentioned, which have dominated for 10 years. They're once in a generational kind of group, and they all came on at once. They've been there for so long. So I think to replace it's always going to be hard. But yeah, there doesn't seem to be another batch coming through that are all. I mean, there's Gabe Medina. He's 21 and he's winning 10-foot cloud break. There's John Florence, obviously. He's pretty good. But surfing rejuvenates itself.
Yeah, well, let's bloody hope so.
Please hang up and try again.
But Ben, at the top of the show, you mentioned the Big Wave World Tour event in Puerto Escondido. What would it take, do you think, to get that as part of the actual CT? I mean, do you think they should have to at least do one event or all of them? Why can't the guys from the CT surf that?
Yeah, it's a good point. They're allowed to. It's obviously sanctioned, so there's no problem there. Who in the top 32 would go to Puerto Escondido, given the forecast, and do well, do you think?
John?
John would. Josh Kerr. He's already surfed a few big waves. He's won a big wave. We saw Cape Fear, didn't we? That was like 20 foot, whatever it was, but just a straight swell slamming into dry rock. Of course, none of those guys were sponsored or some of them were just sort of, I think, must have blown over from Aruba and the prevailing sort of northeast swell. Some out of jail, some just turned up for the crack of it. But, you know, they got put out there and rode 40-foot closeout death rides.
Yeah,
Why can't the top 32?
It was pretty gnarly. I when I was watching it, I couldn't decide whether I sort of wanted... I mean, obviously, I didn't want people to wipe out, but you know what I mean? It's hard to sort of... It doesn't seem real to sort of a very average surfer. So you can't work out if you actually want sort of something really gruesome to kind of go down just as a visual spectacle. I mean, Lane Beachley wasn't in it though. I know we like to mention her on the podcast. She's towed ours, not theirs, as some people like to call it.
Yeah, yeah.
What? Where was she, Ben? You got your finger on the pulse of Australian surfing.
Yeah, I think Lane was. You know what? I think she may have been off doing some type of...
Was she with Wingnut? Was she with Wingnut somewhere?
Yeah.
I don't want to start a rumour, but were her and Wingnut up to something?
Jamie Brizick was a professional surfer throughout the 80s and 90s before turning to writing and filmmaking. He was the editor of Surfing Magazine for 2 years and has been described as a 21st century philosopher and a genius raving surf journalist. His book included We Approach Our Martinis with Such High Expectations, Have Boardwall Travel, and 80s at Echo Beach. His latest book is Becoming Westerly, which is the story of the surfing great Peter Druin and his subsequent transformation by sex change into Westerly Windina. And we have Jamie on the line from LA. How are you, Jamie?
I'm well. It's great to talk to you guys.
Jamie, first of all, before we start, I've got something of a confession to make, and that's I actually used to have a poster of you on my wall as an impressionable child. I got one of those magazines that was kind of full of posters, like everything was like a kind of fold-out poster, and one of them was you, like, in a, I guess, sort of a close-out barrel, in quite sort of bright fluoro stuff. It's fairly typical of the 80s. What, can you remember much about the 80s? Tell us a little bit about that time, being a pro.
I can remember the 80s. I think I know the picture you're talking about. It was from Fernando de Noronha in 1986 or 7. But no, you know, it's funny because the 80s, I think I absolutely, and I don't mean this in any sort of protective way, but the kind of day-glo 80s are dismissed as being almost embarrassing in a way that I think is almost a cliche or it's a stereotype. It was really interesting. It was, being a pro surfer at that time, I felt like, you know, I always said, I've written about it a lot, but like I always felt like I was inspired on the one hand by Yvonne Lendl, who was this tennis champion who was really serious and stoic and rigorous.
Yep.
And then the other inspiration for me was Iggy Pop. And it was like, I feel like a lot of us were that way. It was becoming very athletic. So there were people who were training, and there were people like Tom Kern and Tom Carroll who really, and Martin Potter, who really upped that. But then there was a whole other camp that was kind of like, we're not going to make any serious money out of this. This is like the greatest scam we've ever pulled off in our lives. And let's just have a hell of a lot of fun and basically delay the inevitable, which is, you know, adulthood, responsibility, earning a proper living, figuring out what we're going to do. It was very different to what it is now. There's so much at stake now. There are so many handlers. Everyone's kind of careful about what they're doing because they're, you know, they don't want to blow like retirement money and, or not retirement money, but the ability to set up their families and their grandchildren, etc. Very different story in the '80s.
Who were you running with, Jamie? Who was your sort of, if you had that, you had those two kind of Lendl and Iggy Pop references, but what surfers were dragging you in different directions?
Well, it's funny, you know, one of my dear friends was Wes Lane, who was an American pro who, came from Virginia Beach. He was a very, real kind of black sheep on the tour in the sense of where he came from. I travel with him a lot because we were sponsored by Quicksilver. I travel with Jeff Booth, Bryce Ellis, Ross Clark Jones, Tom Carroll, Doug Silva. I was real close with Todd Chesser. I was, you know, really, really hurt when he died. And yeah, so it's funny because when I think about who I hung out with, I mean, Wes was a serious guy. Ross was an animal. So that duality, that like push and pull.
How was that transition to instead of being a part of it, being the thick of it? And me and Paul are both in the surf media, so we know that we don't write about all the stuff that goes on. There's a bit of a tacit agreement that we leave out the very good bits.
The thing about professional sports or high level athletics is the kind of inner narrative, the voice in your head is telling yourself you're great. It's like Muhammad Ali. I'm the greatest, I'm the greatest, I'm the greatest. And my career ended abruptly. You know, I wasn't cutting it performance-wise. I wasn't bringing in the results. And I was sponsored by Quicksilver. And it was 1991. There was a recession. They said, you know, we can't keep funding you on tour. I was living in Sydney. I got a job with Waves and Tracks magazines and started writing for them. And it was humbling because I literally, in the course of about 2 or 3 months, I went from being one of the guys in the magazines and you know, trying to crack into the top 16 to showing up and talking to the guys with pen and paper in hand and a recorder. But the really cool thing was, as a professional athlete, you live with your blinders on. You're trying as best you can to sort of shut off everything else and be, you know, extract that inner Superman that's going to win you the event. The moment I started writing, And my writing influences were a lot of like the Beats and Henry Miller and people who were all about just like hugging the world and taking in everything and bring it all on. That was so liberating. It was almost as if I'd gotten out of prison.
I've read, you've sort of mentioned a couple of times that you kind of maybe feel surfing these days is a little bit sanitized or lacking that kind of rebellious spirit that it started off with. Is that I mean, the question is two parts, really. Is that probably, is that only ever really going to go one way, or could you see it coming back? And if it were to go back and become a bit more rebellious, let's say, who might be the agents of change? What kind of people out there do you think are there still kind of carrying the beacon?
No, that's such a good question, Paul. You know, I think on some level, like having Wilco dominating the rankings right now is a really good thing. When I was on tour, I remember Derek Hine, who was a journalist, a writer, and a surfer at that time, he said to me something really interesting. He said, whoever's the world champion is, they set the zeitgeist. They kind of like calibrate what the tone of everything is going to be. And if Wilco were to win the world title, that could really open up a lot of more playful fun, less of the kind of, you know, fist-pumping seriousness. I remember reading this great book by John McEnroe, the tennis player, who was famous for, like, mouthing off the linesman. And he wrote this after his career, and he said, you know, and he was playing on the Masters Tour, and he said, whenever I would play in my peak, everyone would get upset because I was very vocal and emotional. Now, if I don't get emotional, they get disappointed. Like, we clearly want that shit. But, you know, someone does something outlandish or vulgar, swears or gets pissed off, and they get fined, and you know, I think it really has gotten more and more of a jock sport, and it makes it less interesting for me, quite frankly. I don't mean to sound like some curmudgeonly guy who's like saying it was better back then, but it really,
the performance is ecstatic
high. I love to watch it. The athletes themselves seem less interesting to me.
How about writers, for example? Who do you read?
You know, I mean, I like Chas Smith. I really liked his book about the North Shore. I thought he said things that no one else said. William Finnegan, Barbarian Days, is a fantastic book about surfing. You know, that blew me away. But he's not a surf writer. He's a New Yorker staff writer.
But I suppose, Jamie, the key is trying to find interesting stories. Is that why you were drawn to Wesley Wendina, or as she's known now, or formerly as Peter Drillin? Because that's, no matter what the sport, or no matter what the background, that's just a pretty incredible story.
I guess when I came to surfing in the late 70s, it was full of eccentric characters. It seemed like this world that was all embracing, and you could really be yourself. You could be strange and weird, and you were embraced. And then slowly in my surf odyssey, so to speak, it went narrower and narrower. And then the same world that might have embraced a character like Westerly in the beginning was booting a Westerly out because they were strange, right? And also there's like homophobia in surfing, and there's, you know, it can be really narrow-minded. And I think on some level, when I met Westerly, so Peter Drillin was this great pro surfer in the 60s and 70s in Australia, one of the best in the world, and then later in life transitioned to a woman, Westerly Wendina. And I love the story partly because I really like Westerly and found her fascinating, incredibly entertaining and interesting. But also, it was almost like I was grinding my own axe against the surf world for being narrow. It was sort of like, okay, I'm going to champion someone that goes against all your little taboos. I wrote a book about Westerly, and Surfer Magazine did a interview, or they did a review and a little interview. And the comments that came out, and I know, you know, people commenting online, they do it, you know, without really much thought. But I was sort of blown away at how narrow surfers are. I mean, there were a lot of comments like, this has no business being in a surf magazine. I'm canceling my subscription. And I'm thinking, are you serious? This is as interesting a surfer as we can possibly find.
People think that surfers are different to mainstream society, or that there's some crazy rebellious free thinkers. But in effect, they just, most of them, present company excluded, just kind of think the same?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And I think, you know, fortunately, because I grew up in the San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles, and so being a surfer from the very get-go, I was an outsider. You know, I was a guy who was literally lying about where he lived so he didn't get, like, kicked out of the water. So I've had an outsider complex for much of my life, and I think on some level now, at 49 years old, and in the last decade, and I lived in New York for a long time, I found my people. The people I'm around, I don't feel. I live in a what's the proper way of putting it? There are so many narrow-minded people out there. I just don't really have. I don't interact in that world much anymore. I'm surrounded by people where they're mostly leftist in their politics. They're open to homosexuality and transgender and bisexuality. You know, there's a real open-mindedness, and mostly artists and writers and what have you. So you're right. I'm as lost as I've ever been, I think, but in a good way. I remember reading something many years ago that it was in a magazine. It was Keith Richards. He was getting on in his years. I think it was one of those "What Have You Learned" in Esquire magazine, and he says this thing about, like, I don't know anything, and anyone that claims to have it figured out, you know, be suspicious of.
Is this some white cunt's joke that black cunts don't get? Because I'm not fucking laughing, Nicola. It's
just another Mona Monday. Okay, we had a huge response from our last podcast, and one of our callers, Tim, became something of a celebrity caller, and a lot of people want to hear him back on the show, and we do like to respond to our public. Joining us down the line once again from the land down under, Tim, how you doing?
I'm pissed off again. Don't worry about that. Mandy, you there?
Yeah, I'm there, mate. I'm listening. How are you, Tim? Good to have you back.
You need to hear this. So for 20 years now, we've been going on this camping trip up the coast, you know. It's just boys, and it's a good time, and it's a party, and we rib in for 3 days, and we come home and salt for the next three. Anyway, we get up there the other week, and... we have a couple of beers the first night. We wake up in the morning. We always pull in and get about 14 kilo of wheat bags and the old sausage, you know, and a couple of kegs of beer on the way up. Anyway, we wake up the first morning. The boys have disappeared. We've gone over the beach and here they are doing yoga. Look, I'm getting pissed off, boys. I'm pissed off with all this organic shit that's going on. You know, in the mood, we head back to camp, we crack a stubby, we have a fucking bomb.
What time is this, Tim?
7:30, Ben, you know, bright and early. Yeah. You got to kick off, the earlier the better. We flip a couple of wheat bags on the barbie. These blokes come back, this is not a word of a lie, like berry cow ham, quail eggs, mate, for breakfast. you know, this organic shit's gone way too far, boys. then they sprinkled me this green shit, and I said, what's that? They said, it's roquet. Later on, I find out it's rocket. We went and had a fish and a surf, and a couple of beers on the beach. You know, those boys are drinking water out of a 20-year-old cave up the road, all this type of stuff. We go back, have a few more wheat bags on the barbie. What do they pull out? Wild albacore tuna fillets. Unbelievable. They toss it in some fermented tofu and throw a bit of pomegranate molasses over the top of it, and I think to myself, what are these blokes on about?
Have any of them got man buns?
I tell you what, Paulie, they might have man buns, but I'll tell you what they've got. Both of them are 40-year-old and they've got 18-year-old haircuts. Now, work that in.
So, Tim, just to be clear, so the main issue is the general move to healthy living, quite fancy produce that makes your blood boil. Is that your main beef?
That's my biggest moan, Mundy. That's my moan for the week. I tell you, it's been killing me. I've been waiting for you to ring me because I need to really get it off my chest.
Well, I really appreciate it, Tim. It's valid. I think you're right. Many people are going and taking this health kick a bit to the extreme. We need to get back to our roots.
Stay off the rocket and keep on the buckets. Cheers, Tim.
Your podcast.
All right, that pretty much brings things to a conclusion for this episode. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget, download us on iTunes, subscribe on there. We're currently about 219,000th on the downloads chart in the sports section. Help us get into that exclusive 218,000 spot by downloading.
And get a dog right up ya. Yeah.